AgriTalk is brought to you by Full Scale from Helena. Grow strong returns this season with breakthrough foliar nutrition from Full Scale at Reproduction. This AgriTalk podcast is brought to you by Acuron corn herbicide from Syngenta, which delivers 5 to 15 more bushels an acre than any other herbicide. Acuron is a restricted-use pesticide. Acuron Yield Advantage range is based on 2016 Syngenta and university trials. Corn has got a 15-cent trading range already today, and it has not gone through support at yesterday's low or resistance at yesterday's high. That's how volatility has ramped up in corn and other ag markets this week. And if you think that's crazy, wait until you hear about what's been happening in D.C.
Live from Hand Grenade Alley via Farm Journal broadcast, this is AgriTalk. This morning, it's our Friday free-for-all. Panelists Jim Wiesmeyer, Sean Haney, and we welcome Mark Recker this morning.
Yeah.
Right after the news, Jennifer Scheich from Farm Journal's Pork. I'm handsome newsman Davis Michelson, and now the host of AgriTalk, Chip Flory.
All right, Davis, thank you so much, buddy. Man, oh, man, what a morning. I've already given Jim Wiesmeyer. Jim does a daily column, okay?
Yes, he does.
Policy update.
Yep.
Update, he calls it. Update.
Mm-hmm.
You know, update to me is like maybe two-thirds a page, something that you get through in 2-3 minutes.
Sure.
You know, it's like 5,000 words this
mm-hmm.
morning
mm-hmm.
because of everything that is going on. It's the issues that we all need to be aware of, the issues mm-hmm. that we all need to have at least some knowledge of. The list is getting longer and longer and longer. And part of it, Davis, is being driven by the executive orders that President Biden is signing. Not all mm-hmm. of it, not all of it, but some of it. The other, and, you know, I don't want to sound like it's Biden and it's Biden only that's causing all of this. It's not, because we get into these news cycles at the start of a new administration every time. It could have been the restart of a Trump administration. We'd be going through mm-hmm. a very active news cycle again. I get mm-hmm. that. I get that. Mm-hmm. But this just seems, again, and we've been talking about it for 2 years. It just feels like this is a very, very intense start of a new administration with the amount of news and issues that we've got to digest and take in and try to
understand.
For sure.
That's yeah. why I referred to as broadcasting live from Hand Grenade Alley. And
right.
once
right.
I got
Perfect.
The news put together this morning, you know, I'm just pulling the pins on these suckers and tossing them your way. Y'all
I'll
have
start,
fun with these, all right?
Start throwing them. Let's go.
Well, here, now this one's not a hand grenade. Export sales of 2.108 million metric tons of corn for delivery to China were announced this morning. That's for the 2020 and 21 marketing year. And export sales of 132,000 metric tons of beans for delivery to China during 21-22, Chip,
man,
a very exciting corn sale, and nice to see beans show up in a daily sale as well.
That's right. 5.85 million metric tons of corn sales announcements to China this mm-hmm. week.
This week, yes.
week, okay? There are also some sales to unknown destinations that some are assuming are also going to China, but I'm not willing to make that assumption. We'll just go to 5.85. That's 230 million bushels of corn, Davis.
Mm-hmm.
230. Mm-hmm. USDA in the January supply and demand report took 100 million bushels off the export estimate. They're going to have right. to put that 100 million bushels back and maybe another 100 million bushels. This corn carryover is getting very, very tight. Sketchy situation.
The U.S. economy shrank in 2020 for the first time since the financial crisis, but grew rapidly in the fourth quarter and is expected to continue recovering. Measured year over year, the economy contracted 3.5% last year, the largest decline since just after World War II and the first since 2009. Measured from the fourth quarter, so this is fourth quarter to fourth quarter, the economy shrank just 2.5%. So there's that full percentage point of improvement there. On the decline, still down 2.5% from the same time last year in the fourth.
Yeah, it's a negative number. it's a negative mm-hmm. number. We're not supposed to have negative numbers.
Right.
And that's a big concern. But man, oh man, when you think about where we were at the start of the third quarter, you know, the middle of the year compared to where we're at now, mm-hmm. we have made some significant progress in digging out of a hole.
Yep. Well, get ready to hit the deck, Chip. Ag sectors and others are closely watching what the Biden administration and Democratic-controlled Congress will do regarding proposed capital gains tax increases. Currently, capital gains are taxed at a preferential rate that can be as low as 15%. Biden's plan would raise the long-term capital gains tax to 39.6% for certain households. That's the largest hike in capital gains tax ever.
Yeah. And then there's other plans out there that would tax capital gains before you've realized the gains.
Right.
On open positions.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? That's Senator Wyden's plan. He would tax open positions, gains on open positions. You can't, if that's the plan, you can't have an open position.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Combating climate change and fixing COVID-19-driven food supply disruptions will top the Senate Ag Committee's agenda, mirroring the Biden administration's priorities. Incoming Chairwoman Debbie Stabenow said Thursday, quote, from the ongoing pandemic to the devastating climate crisis, our farmers, families, and rural communities need help. This is American Farm Bureau Association President Zippy Duvall urges Congress to quickly resume making CFAP payments. Here, I got to get this one in. President Biden wants to revive the Obama-era WOTUS rule. Another grenade for you. Former President Donald Trump claimed that the rule, quote, gave bureaucrats virtually unlimited authority. Another one, shrinking global oil inventories and soaring demand could push oil prices from a little over $50 per barrel now to $80 per barrel later this year. And finally, General Motors said it will strive to make every vehicle it sells zero emissions by 2035. Did not say that they would completely cancel the production of gasoline engines, but
that's a change. Zero emissions is zero emissions is different than than electric vehicle. Well, believe me, I'm sure we're going to get into that at some point today.
I can't wait. I can't
right,
wait.
Davis,
pull the
thanks,
pin
buddy.
And
let's
step
bring
away.
In Jennifer Scheich. Jennifer's the editor. Jennifer's the editor of Farm Journal's Pork. How you doing, Jennifer?
Great.
Good. 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 Okay. Cobank has got some suggestions out there on what the protein sector might be looking to do following the disruptions of last year. What's on the list?
Well, you know, I think flexibility is really important. And thankfully, in the pork and beef markets, we're able to have a little bit more flexibility in where we send that product. But the new report says that they don't expect food service sales to return to pre-pandemic levels until the second half of 2022. And so, you know, that's quite a ways out. And for, you know, the sector like the beef sector, who depends a lot on getting that product into those, into restaurants and hotels and so forth, you know, that's going to be a challenge. Fortunately, you know, they've done well with hamburger and more of those, you know, limited food, you know, limited service food sectors. And so that's been helpful. But, you know, I thought that was interesting. And, you know, the other thing they noted was that for pork, they're not seeing quite as much of those value-added products and the convenience products in the grocery stores because they're having some of the changes in the plants.
Interesting. Interesting. I do know this. I mean, people have figured out how to cook pork at home. I hear it all the time now, Jennifer, about how impressed they are that they can do pulled pork at home in the oven. They never even thought about it before the disruption.
That's so true. And they're finding that it lasts quite a while, too, and they can do a lot with it. So there's a lot of good things, but some challenges ahead.
Yep. Tastes good. Great value. Good for you. It all counts. Thank you, Jennifer. That's Jennifer Scheich, editor of Farm Journal's Pork. Free for all next. Adverse weather conditions paired with some herbicides can cause crop injury early in the season. Today, I'm joined by Steve Gomm, corn herbicide product lead with Syngenta. Steve, why are these crop-safe corn herbicides so important in preventing that early season injury?
as most of us know, we've had quite a few curveballs from Mother Nature these last few years, especially 2019, making it even more important for growers to assess their weed management program to ensure it can adapt. Much of the Corn Belt often faces cold temperatures and rain-delayed planting, which can really impact the ability for growers to apply their pre-emergent herbicides effectively and timely. Fortunately, there are flexible, crop-safe herbicides on the market that will both help crops withstand unpredictable weather and protect them from those yield-robbing weeds.
Okay, cool. So the considerations that we should be thinking about when we're selecting a crop-safe product, go through that.
Firstly, it's critical that growers use a corn herbicide that has been proven to deliver excellent pre- and post-emergent crop safety. Even in those adverse weather conditions, some may not know that not all products include a crop safener. And even if they do, particularly in the case of some generic products, it's unknown what safener is being used or at what rate.
Okay, it's all good, but it's still got to yield. So for a grower looking to not only protect their crops, but also maximize yield potential, what do you recommend?
Well, only Acuron corn herbicide has proven crop safety. That's because it provides excellent pre-emergent and post-emergent crop safety across a wide range of soil types, weather conditions, and plant genetics, so really in any environment. Growers can enjoy application flexibility from 28 days pre-plant, including burn down, up to 12-inch corn. And even in cool, wet conditions, Acuron is unlikely to cause crop injury when used according to the label rate. Best of all, it's a dependable, easy-to-use formulation that contains a proven crop safener called Binoxacor for improved crop safety. So Acuron's
excellent.
Our go-to herbicide.
Excellent, Steve. Thank you. To find out how crop safety could impact your revenue potential and to see how Acuron can provide an extra 5 to 15 bushels an acre to your yield, try Syngenta's online calculator at www.findmorebushels.com or talk to your local Syngenta retailer. And remember to always read and follow label instructions. Acuron is a restricted-use pesticide. Acuron yield advantage range is based on 2016 Syngenta and university trials.
AgriTalk is brought to you by Smart Nutrition MAP plus MST. Learn how to boost your soil's performance and maximize ROI with Smart Nutrition MAP plus MST at smartnutritionmst.com.
Welcome back to AgriTalk. I'm your host, Chip Laurie. We're going to charge straight ahead into this one. Pro Farmer Policy Analyst Jim Wiesmeyer, how you doing today, buddy?
Pretty good, Chip. I did want to say this was the largest daily corn sale to China and the second largest daily corn sale ever. What was the largest? It's not even a country anymore. USSR, 3.72 million tons, January the 9th, 1991.
Interesting. And buying corn in 91,
yes.
Russia was. Huh. Okay. Jim, before we get the Sean and Mark in here, we've been talking about Chinese corn demand on AgriTalk and how it was going to be that much bigger than most people anticipated. I don't think we can say that it's going to be bigger than most people anticipate anymore because the expectations have gotten so much bigger, but there's still work to do on the balance sheet from USDA.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, last month USDA cut corn exports. So now they're in a dilemma.
Yeah.
What will they do? And an increasing number of analysts, Chip, USDA, I think right now is 1.5 billion bushel corn carryover. I've got industry analysts in the 900 million to 1.1 billion bushel area.
Under a billion. Crazy.
Yes.
Crazy.
Some.
Well, with under a billion for a possible corn carryover out there floating around, let's bring in Iowa farmer Mark Recker. How you doing, Mark? Welcome to the free-for-all.
Well, thanks, Chip. I appreciate being asked, and hopefully, you know, we can get through a lot of these topics. The stack of issues is pretty thick, so. But talking about corn export sales, that's fantastic to talk about. That's some positive news.
Yeah, yeah. Now, Mark has been on the show before. It's been a while, but Mark has been on the show before. Mark is a past president of the Iowa Corn Growers Association. He's well known across the state of Iowa and in the corn industry. I just thank you so much for making time for us, Mark. Really appreciate you doing this. What do you make of what's going on with China and the corn buys?
Well, you know, it's interesting that what's taking place here with China. I mean, you can contribute, obviously, some of this to the trade agreement from the past few years, hopefully, but also just that internal demand that's been building, something we've been kind of hanging our hat on for a long time, Chip, as farmers, that right. We've always been told China's going to want to buy corn, going to need corn. And maybe we're getting to that point in conjunction with the trade deal. But also, in addition to that, what we want to see is them buy ethanol, get in the ethanol market and help us out there. So that'd be fantastic. Either way, it's a great opportunity, marketing opportunity. Farmers have not had a good past couple of years. This is a tremendous marketing opportunity for us to take advantage of.
Excellent. Excellent point right there, Mark. And ADM is saying that China did buy 200 million gallons of ethanol, which would be roughly 20% of a really good export year for ethanol. So It feels like it's happening, Mark, is what it feels like. It's pretty cool.
It does. Everything's kind of coming together. Yeah.
Yep, it certainly does. Sean Haney, Real Agriculture, Real Ag Radio. Haney, I'm going to bring you in with this. I had somebody on the show yesterday afternoon that said everything that China, not everything, but China may be rebuilding stocks in anticipation of future conflicts with the world.
Well, yeah, that's definitely a possibility. There is a lot of tension on that India-China border, as just one example. There are people like Taiwan. When you just open up Foreign Affairs magazine once in a while, and you'll read some. There's a lot of people, Chip, that believe that we're headed to that kind of a military conflict. Yeah. That it's like sort of like the issues World War One kind of conflict between old economy and new. Like there's a lot of people. I really hope that is not the direction that we are headed. We have seen, though, I wanted to point out, we have seen, as China has really obviously been buying a lot of agricultural commodities, we're sure not hearing as much about some of the other things that China is doing that are quite nefarious in character.
Right.
And one of those is the two Canadians that are still detained in that country. And I, that's one of the things I'm really hoping the Biden administration pushes for is the release of those two Michaels.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. And it's something that we obviously need to keep in focus and not forget that nefarious happenings are happening out there. Okay. Mark, you brought up ethanol. Let's jump to that, because all of a sudden we've got big oil, some of who I'm sure are looking for exemptions to blending requirements under the Renewable Fuel Standard. We've got some big oil companies that all of a sudden are thinking, you know what, maybe we better switch gears here and get ethanol to come along and help defend liquid fuel for the future. It just feels icky, Mark, to have big oil courting ethanol now.
Isn't that interesting? Isn't that rich all of a sudden after, you know, the past 4 years and beyond that, going back to as long as the ethanol industry has been building, that the oil industry refineries have been trying to undercut us, much less bury the industry. And now they like to play ball, knowing, in fact, that they need ethanol. They need ethanol. They need low carbon, high octane. So now they want to talk to us. You know, I think there's a lot of options for ethanol going forward as a low carbon fuel. The focus is on electric, and it's going to be, but there's going to be opportunities that we're going to have to look for and find for ethanol as a low carbon fuel. You know, we don't need to marry ourselves to the oil industry necessarily, but I'm sure there'll be considerations and talking going forward toward that.
Yeah, no
Chip,
doubt.
Is this one of those, the enemy of my enemy is my friend? Is that where we apply one of these quotes?
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, that's what it's feeling like. I no question about it. Jim, does ethanol hold their nose and go forward and say, okay, we'll work with big oil on this?
Well, you saw this week the American fuel and petrochemical manufacturers confirmed that they've been talking to the corn biofuel industries. But then NCGA, you know, CEO, who we know quite well, John Doggett, told Reuters no such meeting was scheduled, you know, with the various groups. So he kind of signaled to me that I don't think he sees a meeting anytime soon. But,
Coop,
you know, let's hope, because
Jeff
I think there's
RFA
progress.
Jeff Cooper at RFA has said, listen, we know about the meeting. We just don't know if we're going to attend.
Hmm.
So why wouldn't they attend?
At least hear them out. I don't know, Mark. What do you think? Why should we attend? Should Ethanol attend that meeting?
So I think you need to be open to conversations with, you know, who you can. But I think you need to be really cautious. And I think Jeff Cooper put it really well that we've kind of been down this road. We know how they tend to treat partners, that industry. You just got to be really cautious going forward with them.
Yeah, absolutely. All I know, I mean, guys, we've been talking about the high octane, low carbon argument, environmental argument for ethanol on AgriTalk for a while. When I say for a while, I mean years. It feels like an opportunity to move forward and to build a market as we transition, Jim, to more and more electric vehicles out there on the road. But there's a lot of fuel to be used between now and the EVs out there, right?
Absolutely. And you just saw the Harvard study that showed ethanol greenhouse gas emissions 46% lower than gasoline. So that has to be updated for EPA and other lawmakers who took a look at this several years ago.
Yeah. Mark, that reminds me, I mean, these studies that are coming out now on the carbon intensity levels of ethanol blended fuels. This is stuff that the corn growers have been arguing about and pointing at and saying, update your studies, update your research for 10 or 15 years. And they're finally doing it.
They are. It's absolutely right. We've been making that case that we have not been treated fairly by these models that score corn appropriately, not only how the ethanol production, but how corn is produced now. Corn that's produced, you know, in a more sustainable manner, we need to get scoring done for that, because if you include that, that gets the carbon score even lower and competes a lot better with electric going forward.
And here's why it's happening. Here's why it's happening. Here's why all of a sudden people are paying attention to it. It's because big oil is backing away and saying, listen, our future, liquid fuel future, may depend on getting to a net zero carbon output. And the only way that that's going to happen is if we've got a more efficient fuel, a more environmentally friendly fuel, a low carbon footprint fuel that we can blend with our gasoline. We need the octane. We need new motors. We need new technology to keep liquid fuel alive. It just enforces in my mind that it's been big oil holding down the ethanol argument for as long as they have. Frustrating. Okay, we're going to move on. We've got a heck of a start to today's free-for-all. Mark Recker, farmer from Iowa, Sean Haney, Real Agriculture, and Jim Wiesmeyer from Pro Farm. Hey, everybody. Chip Flora here. I've got a great deal for you to tap into all the information at the 2021 Top Producer Summit. You don't have to travel. It's all online, and I'll pick up half the tab. That's right, because you listen to AgriTalk, Top Producer is working with us to take your fee from $150 down to $75. Use promo code AgriTalk when you register at tpsummit.com. It's a half-price deal only for AgriTalk listeners. Use promo code AgriTalk at tpsummit.com.
Time for Markets Now with the experts from Pro Farmer.
And joining us now, Pro Farmer editor Brian Grady. Beach, man, oh man. 230 million bushels of corn sales announced to China this week alone. And we're seeing a reaction in the market today.
Yeah, we are. We're trading to the upside. But, you know, I think the thing is that we look back to that mid-January high and we poked above it multiple days this week to new contract highs. But we're struggling to find buyers above that level. And so that's somewhat concerning. From a technical standpoint, the type of bullish demand news we've thrown in the corn market this week, you would expect that we would just rip higher, and we haven't seen that. So I don't know if it's bulls catching their breath, if it's a warning sign, what it is, but it's something that needs to be watched.
Well, wheat's coming along for the ride today, but it feels like beans are still kind of holding corn back.
Yeah, the soybean market looks tired right now, to be honest with you. somewhat the same in the wheat market. It is participating today. You know, wheat is a feed now that's competing with corn, and normally you see the wheat market rally when it's a food as opposed to a feed, but the corn strength is causing the wheat market to definitely take notice and rally here.
Okay, very good. Take us over to the livestock trade. Some more mixed action.
Yeah, kind of quiet, to be honest with you. I mean, we've seen the futures. They're out in front of the cash markets, both cattle and hogs. And so, you know, we're waiting on the cash to catch up. Both cash markets strengthened this week. Cash cattle were up about $3, depending on where all the trade finishes up. And the cash hog market, the index rallied about $2 this week. So, you know, it's just kind of a waiting game at this point, a catch-up game.
Very good. All right. We got the cattle inventory report today, too. All right. Thanks, Brian. That's Pro Farmer Editor Brian Grady.
Opinions expressed on AgriTalk do not necessarily reflect the views of Farm Journal Broadcasting, affiliate stations, or sponsors.
Always wanted to ask a machine repeat a question? Hey, here's your chance, folks. Join me live in the Equipment Edition of Farm Journal Field Day's online farm show on Tuesday, February 9th at noon Central. I'll be hanging out in the network lounge. Come join me, we'll talk machinery, and I'll answer your questions.
You guys, that's a lot of fun to have that conversation with Greg Peterson, Machinery Pete. So if you've got any questions, February 9th is coming up. He's going to be answering questions live for you at the Farm Journal Field Day's Equipment Edition. It's free. Check it out, farmjournalfielddays.com, and it will take you to all the information that you need on how to get there. We got a free-for-all going, and it is going. We've got Pro Farmer Policy Analyst Jim Wiesmeyer, Sean Haney from Real Agriculture, Real Ag Radio, and Mark Recker, Iowa Farmer, here. Jim, the other night, you kind of hit me with a text, and then I started to put some word out on Twitter that the $2.3 billion in supplemental CFAP money that was targeted primarily for contract poultry and contract hog producers was put on hold. There's a pause on it. It's under review. What's status here?
Well, this is part of a usual incoming administration, in this case, the Biden, to review various rules in the waning weeks of the prior administration. So this is somewhat normal, Chip. Now, on this one, it is on pause. It'll come back. But I noticed okay. Debbie Stabenow, the incoming Senate Ag Committee chairwoman, applauded the move and said, you know, it didn't really address the provisions in the final legislation calling for ag aid for farm workers, smaller food processors, and others in the supply chain. So we could see some changes in this supplemental CFAP, Chip.
Yeah, and how that $2.3 billion is divvied up. Now, what about on the $13 billion that's in CFAP 3? Is that also under review?
I was told it's under review because even though it's law, it's under review because they do have to write a rule for that. Plus, they have to, you know, do some reprogramming of the software. But I don't see many changes in that. That was widespread applauding from, you know, both sides of the political aisle.
Right.
It could be tweaked, but I don't see many changes, Jeff.
Right, right. Mark,
it definitely gives you. So sorry, Chip. I was just going to say, it definitely gives you a bit of an indication on what's important to this administration, the comments that she did make in regards to that review, though.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Needing to look at could that $2.3 billion be used in other areas more effectively? What do you make of this, Mark?
Yeah, it seems largely procedural to me, Chip. I think the same thing happened with the last two small refinery exemptions that the EPA released. I think the Biden administration held those up, or the courts did, to review those, which hopefully they pull those back. But it seems procedural, and like Sean said, they're going to, as the vision of the administration tells you, that they're maybe going to look at ways to allocate this money a little differently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know,
Chip, that, Stabenow now has some of her staff at USDA, and I think that's key.
Okay. Yeah, that is key. Now, as long as we're talking about Stabenow, Debbie Stabenow from Michigan is the chairman of the Senate Ag Committee. some of her comments, some of her thoughts were in, Jim, you reported on it overnight. It was in Pro Farmers First Thing today. Stabenow says she will seek to use climate legislation to put more money into conservation programs. Okay. That encourage growers to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Great. She plans aggressive action on legislation to help both farmers and foresters cut down on their emissions and to create a new source of income from the adoption of practices that store more carbon in soil and trees. Mark, on one hand, this all sounds really good. On the other hand, it sounds like legislation and mandates on how you're going to do what you're supposed to do.
Right. But the devil's in the details with this, with knowing no more than that, Chip. Now, I will say what we're seeing appears a lot of it's market driven, aside from what the government would like to do here. There's a lot of private companies that are encouraging farmers to do, to take on sustainable practices that are figuring out that market. I work with one in Seed Corn, a large company that is driving sustainability. So a lot of this is market driven. We just got to sit back and see what we're talking about as far as government involvement in this before we get really too worried about it yet, I think.
Okay.
But Chip, here's another key. The biggest news, I think, in her comments on using climate change funding and tapping CCC Charter Act at USDA is to get a bigger budget baseline for the next farm bill. Now, that'll go well for farmers. Mm-hmm. And she and her staff are known for their aggressiveness, and they usually get what they want.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And in all of these sustainability initiatives, the benchmark year is really one of the details that is critically important. You know, some farmers want you to go back 30 years to the beginning of no-till. In Canada, we've had fights about this on our CFS we've been developing and with some of the codes of practice on the grain industry. Is it as of today? So the things that you change as of today, that it discounts completely your prior no-till, which is an example. And should there be a context set up by the government, a structure set up by the government and private and left to private industry and let the market work? Or should that money come out of government, the CCC, and the government's funding some of that? That's, I think, a big, big question. And
it is.
If it comes out of the CCC, is that market distorting? And like, where did that unravels a whole other realm of things?
You are going down exactly the right path that I think we need to go down. Now, on Tuesday, we had a fantastic, I think, conversation about carbon and development of the carbon markets in both segments, in segment two and segment three of the AM show. In the first segment, we talked with Debbie Reed from the Ecosystem Services Market Consortium. Now, when I asked her that question, what is it based on? Sean, she said the market is being built on change. So it's a change in practice that's going to make you eligible for payments. Mm-hmm. Okay? Now, in the next segment, we talked with SIBO Technologies and People's Company. And in that conversation, the payment would be based on practices used on an annual basis. So if you've been no-till, according to Debbie, you don't get paid for no-till. But under the SIBO Tech structure, if you've been no-till and you continue to go no-till, then you can get paid for future no-till activities. You see what you get? What I'm talking about?
Oh yeah, you could write a book just with questions about all of this.
Yeah,
it's extremely technical.
Exactly, Mark. The bottom line here is that we're developing this market, and I love Sean's comment question: should USDA be buying carbon credits, or is it better left to the private sector?
Well, it appears it's going to be a hodgepodge right now from the private sector, Chip, because the large question, who's the clearinghouse for this? Who's going to determine if the farmer, what his practices are, how they measure, and if the farmers are getting a fair shake? I mean, that's what farmers should concern themselves with. Are they being compensated appropriately with this? And there is no clear answer yet, and that's going to take time to sort out.
Yeah.
Yeah, because when we talk about a source of income, okay, what are we talking like that number could the expectations around that number could be very, very wide. So as discussed, devil's in the details.
Yeah.
Well, Sean, watch the Paris Club agreement. What's the set year for that?
Oh, Jim, I don't know. I'm not scared to say that. We're huge battle up here in Canada right now. They're developing it's called responsible grain. It's a code of conduct, basically a code of practice for producing grain to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And there's a lot of pushback on the government, the part of, this telling me how to farm. And so Chip, you made that comment earlier. That's something that should not be ignored. That's going to be a big battle, I think, in the U.S. as this develops, is what are the rules and regulations that I need to be abiding by in order to qualify for some of these things.
Right. Well, you won't have farmer state lawmaker buy-in unless they have some payment for legacy cost for all those producers who went to no-till early. It's like I had two sisters. One was more feisty than the other. And when my feisty sister acted better, she got rewarded. And the other one, who was always nice, never got rewarded. So that's not right.
Mark, do you think that's right? There's got to be some sort of legacy compensation on this?
You go down that rabbit hole, and ideally you would think that people should be rewarded for that. But it seems like in the past, if you're talking government programs, if you've already been doing it, CSP, for instance, practices you've already been doing pre-CSP, Conservation Security Program, you didn't get compensated for that. It's the things you took on while the government, right, while the program was after was enacted. So if it's like that, then it's going to be hard to go back and do legacy and reward for that.
Well, that's there's been talk point. Of a one-year payment only, so that could be a compromise.
Okay, for government support, but when it comes to what this carbon market is going to look like going forward, we're not going to settle it today the next 45 seconds.
And we also can't rest on our laurels the last 30 years of no-till. We also got to be talking about what the future practices look like, too, to also make a difference when it comes to this, if we really want to get this as a source of income.
Right, right. And if we're saving and sequestering carbon in agriculture and we're getting credits for doing that, organically growing those credits, and then we turn around and sell them to a company that wants to feel good about reducing their footprint, does anything really change? I mean, that's why the market will be driven by change going forward, I think.
It starts with a plan. That's why America's Conservation Ag Movement is inviting you to get your farm business ready for 2021 with a free resource stewardship planning guide. Get your free guide today at agweb.com/ACAM.
Welcome back to Ag. We're talking the free-for-all. We've got Jim Wiesmeyer, Sean Haney, and Mark Recker rolling with us today. Jim, during the break, you mentioned that phase one trade agreement with China now under review. What's happening?
Yeah, Bloomberg was the first to report that the Biden administration has the phase one trade agreement with China, quote, under review, along with the rest of the U.S. posture toward Beijing. And that was from White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki. So she says everything in the past administration has been put under review. Now, what that means, we don't know yet. I think that they'll follow through on phase one, but I think that lowers the prospects for any phase two, Jim.
Mark, how do you view phase one agreement right now, Mark? Is it something that we should stick with, or do you like the review process? What?
Well, I think this administration needs to evaluate phase one. I think they need to take the time to evaluate the impact and see what it looks like going forward. And go from there. I'm not a big fan of just pulling out what the last administration did. I don't think that's beneficial. I don't think that's helpful. What I would like to see is if this administration evaluates trade one, then think about reentering the Trans-Pacific Partnership in that region, which I think is a huge mistake to pull out of. Let's look at maybe tweaking this, get into that, then we really have a foothold in that part of the world.
Excellent. Haney, you were going to say something?
I think Mark kind of covered it. I think it just
okay.
It's also good posturing to show, like, we don't know what the Trump administration was doing here. We better just have a look at what's going on. Like, I think it's more marketing than anything.
Well, let's connect some dots here. Remember what Sean cautioned about China? Are they leading up to something dastardly? And I'm not saying this is a negative, but we're putting a lot of eggs in China's basket for U.S. agriculture. We need to disperse some of that with more good trade agreements.
And the U.K. is looking to also get into the CPTPP, so the U.S. would not be alone in trying to enter that agreement after the fact.
If there's two trying to get in, I think it makes it's like a reevaluation of CPTPP. Okay, there's two new potential partners out there. Let's bring them in. You know, the last time when we were talking about TPP, though, Jim, Hillary Clinton wanted out of TPP too. So
yes.
Would there be enough support in Congress to at least take a look at getting into CPTPP?
I think that there's support if there's significant changes, and we need for the Biden group to define what are those changes to come back into the TPP. And I think we could see the first indication of that soon when Japan's foreign minister comes to visit Biden at the White House.
Okay. Yeah. All right. First couple of weeks here, Jim, there's been several executive orders signed. There's been lots of speculation, a lot of it on potential changes to the tax code. We talked about it a little bit in the news on capital gains. Where do you see, what's the status? What's going to happen? What won't?
Well, if the Democrats in Congress, which I think they will, want to eventually put tax increases or tax reform, to be fair, in the budget reconciliation, because that way it will only need 50 votes, or the majority votes, yep, rather than 60, we've got to see some details. But if you go on what Biden said during the campaign, and the Finance Committee chairman, who you mentioned, Wyden from Oregon, they're saying they want to boost individual income taxes for some, raise the estate taxes really exponentially by cutting the Fed exemption in half, eliminate the step-up basis rules, and increase the taxable rate of capital gains. That's a mouthful there. And I think there'll be a number of Democrats against this and many Republicans. So some changes are coming, Chip, but I don't think all of these.
Right. Mark, some of these proposed changes on the estate taxes, capital gains, that would be very detrimental to small businesses, wouldn't it?
That would be, if it turns into serious legislation. It would be, farmers, the stepped up basis, incredibly important. A reasonable exemption like it is. I think what most people say right now, reasonable exemption is important. The reality of it becoming legislation, the practical matter of it is totally different, because I think it won't be tied to COVID or reconciliation, because I think there's other priorities like COVID funding. And secondly, if you don't get that, then you got to get 60 votes. And I even think 50, like Jim said, is really tough on this, because there's Democrats in the middle that won't support this red states.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. Now, I just want to give this example really quick, because I know that there's people out there that are listening that are thinking this is a farm issue, the estate tax thing, small business. Why should they get those breaks? Now, understand this. Now, if your parents bought a house for $100,000 and you inherit that house and it is now worth $200,000, but you don't need the house, so you sell the house and you sell it for $205,000. The way things are with the step-up in basis, you would be taxed on $5,000, the difference between the value and the selling amount. Now, without the step-up in basis, you would be on the hook for taxes on $105,000, what your parents paid for it and what you sold it for. So that's the importance of this step up in basis when it comes to estate taxes. It's not just a small business thing, guys. I mean, we're talking about the difference between, $1,000 in taxes versus $35,000 in taxes.
Well, And we've been talking here, you know, all this spending, all the stimulus, you know, government's injecting money into the economy so that we can continue to see the Dow Jones on a roll. This is one of the consequences. Somebody's got to pay for it.
That's right.
And it's not good.
That's right. Mark Recker, great debut on the Free for All. Thank you, buddy. Appreciate your time.
Hey, thanks. Always enjoy the opportunity to talk, Chip.
Excellent. Well, I hope you're willing to answer the phone when we call again to get you back on, because we're going to be doing that. All right, that's Mark Recker. He's up here in Northeast Iowa. Sean Haney, thanks, buddy. Appreciate it.
Hey, great to be here. Everybody,
what are you talking
weekend.
About on the show today, real quick?
Hey, it's a Real Egg Issues panel, kind of like our version of the Free For All here,
nice.
Discussing the big issues of the week. Yeah, for sure.
Hit it. All right. Thank you, Sean. Jim Wiesmeyer, go finish up the newsletter, buddy.
Will do.
All right. That's Jim Wiesmeyer, Pro Farmer Policy Analyst. Hey, thank you so much for listening this morning. You got to come back this afternoon. You want to talk some GameStop? We're going to talk some GameStop. Tommy Grisafi from Advanced Trading. Thanks to Acuron Corn Herbicide for sponsoring the AgriTalk podcast. Talk to your retailer about how you can get 5 to 15 more bushels with Acuron. Acuron is a restricted-use pesticide. Acuron Yield Advantage range is based on 2016 Syngenta and University trials.